John S. Tanner was born in Salt Lake City and raised in South Pasadena, California. Graduated with highest honors in English from BYU in 1974, following which he continued his studies at the University of California at Berkeley, receiving his PhD in 1980. At that point, he taught at Florida State for 2 years. And frankly, Bob Millett, I've been impressed by both the number and quality of our faculty who have come here from Florida State. Now, the immediate inclination is to refer to Florida State as our farm club. And I had at one point considered informing them of that fact. But I was concerned about the rejoinder, which would have been in two parts. Number one, that farm club is an athletic term. And when you turn to athletics, the farm club image isn't exactly justified by what happened in the Pigskin Classic just about a year ago. Professor Tanner is the editor of a journal on medieval and Renaissance studies and has published widely on religion and literature with an emphasis on John Milton. He serves as chair of the university's Committee on Competence and Academic Freedom and has received numerous teaching awards, including 1989 Honors Professor of the Year, the Al Kuhn Fellowship in General Education, and a Cougar Groomer Award for Excellence in Teaching. In 1991, he was a Fulbright Scholar in Brazil, where he served a church mission 20 years earlier. Served in many BYU callings and church callings generally, and is currently the president of the BYU Fourth Stake. President Tanner and his wife, Susan Winder, who was in turn the daughter of a former member of our Board of Trustees, are the parents of 5 children.
By the way, thank you for the introduction and for that lovely music, Sister Giovanni. In a facetious little essay entitled On Transcendental Meta-Worry, the scientific author Lewis Thomas observes that worrying is the most natural and spontaneous of human functions. Man is the worrying animal. This rare capacity to worry, however, Lewis continues, is a trait that needs further development, awaiting perfection. Most of us tend to neglect the activity, living precariously on the thin edge of anxiety, but never plunging in. To remedy this, Thomas recommends the practice of transcendental worry, or TW, preferably before work or late in the evening just before insomnia. To practice TW, Lewis recommends the following. First, you make yourself as uncomfortable as possible. Tense all your muscles, close your eyes tight until the effort causes a slight tremor in your eyelids. Focus on the muscular effort required to breathe, preferably attempting to breathe through one nostril at a time. And then repeat to yourself a suitable mantra like, worry, worry. Soon you'll experience the vertiginous pleasure of anxiety. Worries will circle in and out of your consciousness like carrion fowl, swirling images of burning rainforest, swelling pimples, unpaid visa bills, the national debt, the testing center, expanding waistlines, receding hairlines, late papers and finals for classes that you've never even attended. Surrender yourself wholly to this sense of anxiety. And then, if you're like I am, blessed with the right nervous temperament, you will sink to the final stages of TW, pure worry about worry itself. At this point, you will have attained what Lewis calls the wisdom of the West, or TMW, transcendental meta-worry. I confess that sometimes late at night, between sleep and wake, I experience this rarefied form of TMW, or worry about worry. I speak today as one personally familiar with what a song in the 60s called the chilly hours and minutes of uncertainty. I do so, however, in order to speak of faith and hope, with which I am also intimately familiar. According to Parley P. Pratt, the pioneers who first endured that terrible winter in the valley suffered more from fear than from actual hunger. Think about that. Remember how hungry the saints were. The people tried eating crows, thistle tops, barks, roots, seagull lilies, anything that might fill an empty stomach or offer nutriment. Yet they suffered most from fear. For the valley was new, says Brother Pratt, neither was it proven that grain could be raised. Uncertainty can be more chilling than winter, doubt more gnawing than hunger, tempests of the mind more fearful than pelting rain. As Shakespeare's King Lear remarks, the tempest of my mind doth from my senses take all feeling else save what beats there. In a similar vein, Alexander Solzhenitsyn described a peculiar reaction evident in many people who were picked up by the Soviet secret police. Sometimes the principal emotion of the person arrested, Solzhenitsyn says, is arrest. Arrested is relief and even happiness. After all, Solzhenitsyn explains, there is a kind of exhaustion that is worse than any kind of arrest. He illustrates this point by the example of a priest who, having eluded arrest for 8 years, suffered so painfully from this harried life that when he was finally arrested in 1942, he sang hymns of praise to God. Not knowing when or if an affliction will end is often more taxing than the affliction itself. This kind of suffering, which I call the ordeal within the ordeal, constitutes a perennial condition in the human predicament. All ages echo with the ancient cry, "How long, O Lord, how long?" We suppose that we could brave most any hardship if we only knew when it would pass and if it would pass. Think how patiently, for example, you older single students would bear being unmarried if you knew that in 3 years you'd marry a good person. Or alternatively, that you'd never marry. It's not being single, but the uncertainty that can seem so unendurable. Likewise, think how stoically you married students would cope with being poor if you were sure your plight were temporary, that you would be able to afford a home and have the employment you desire and that you've prepared for. How much more courageously and cheerfully would we endure our trials if we knew their outcome? Why, we could even face death more boldly if we knew the time of our demise. In periods of prolonged distress, we yearn for the Lord to carry us to a mountaintop as he did Moses, and there reveal in detail the course of our lives. Instead, God requires us to wander like Abraham, as strangers and pilgrims on the earth, living on promises. To live on this side of the veil is to walk by faith, not by sight. It is to feel after the Lord as he lights our way home, one step at a time. We've just sung the lines by John Henry Newman that express this theme. Newman wrote "Lead Kindly Light" aboard ship on the way home from England, on the way home to England from Italy. He was homesick and seasick. He just had malaria. And though he didn't know it yet, he was also about to take the first faltering steps on a spiritual pilgrimage that would ultimately lead him and many who followed him to another church. In those circumstances, Newman writes, "Lead kindly light amid the encircling gloom. Lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Keep thou my feet. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me." This last line contains a phrase that became a motto for my wife, Susan, and me through long years of uncertainty in graduate school. "I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me. One step enough." How often Susan and I have taken comfort in this phrase. Yet even with those words on our lips, we still tread gingerly into a future that seemed precarious and into which we could see safe footing for only one small step ahead. Yet we crave precisely what we professed not to ask for. Namely, we wanted to see the distant scene. For like most everybody else, we yearn for certainty and would avoid risk if we could, or at least consign it to a risk manager What a modern and intriguing modern invention that is, risk management. Wouldn't it be great if we could give over life's truly serious risks, like whom to marry or what to believe, to someone else? Let them do that risk management. Susan and I dislike suspense. It makes us, well, nervous. Susan's the kind of reader who likes to skip to the end of the novel when the suspense becomes too intense. And I'm the kind of fan who sometimes opts to watch a game, a close game, on replay after I know the outcome. The dramas of our own lives, however, are not available to us on video or in novels. We can neither fast forward nor can we read ahead. Because our tribulations unfold in real time, the only way out, alas, is through. This means we must endure not only the hardships, but the ordeal of anxiety within the ordeal. It means we must live on promises and walk by faith. To walk by faith is to follow in the footsteps of Abraham, the spiritual father of all those who sojourn as pilgrims and strangers on the earth. In Hebrews we read, "By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country," that means foreign country, "dwelling in tabernacles," which means tents, "with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Not knowing whither he went, Abraham left not only his city, but city life itself, and the cradle of civilization, in order to become a nomad." Now, when Abraham left Haran, he writes in the book of Abraham, the nomadic Abraham writes, "Therefore, eternity was our covering and our rock and our salvation as we journeyed from Haran to come into the land of Canaan." Moreover, Abraham did not cease to be a nomad after he arrived in the promised land. Rather, even in Canaan, he dwelt in tabernacles as in a strange or foreign country, while his nephew Lot chose to live in the cities on the well-watered plain of Jordan and reap the consequence of that choice. Abraham dwelt not in cities, for he looked for a city which hath foundation, says the writer of Hebrews, whose builder and maker is God. And he taught us by his example that here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. As Abraham wandered through Canaan, he was promised the land over and over again. Yet when Sarah died, Abraham had to buy the cave of Machpelah in which to bury her. How poignant are Abraham's words to the sons of Heth from whom he purchased this cave. Abraham said, "I am a stranger and sojourner with you. Give me possession of a burying place that with you that I may bury the dead out of my sight." The land was Abraham's by covenant, yet near the end of his life, he did not even own a plot of ground sufficient to inter Sarah's body. Later, Abraham was buried in this same cave, the only property he ever owned in Canaan. No wonder Stephen the martyr says that the Lord gave Abraham none inheritance in Canaan, no, not so much as to set his foot on, but he promised him only that he would give Abraham the land for a possession, and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. Abraham spent his days living on promises, not only with respect to the promised land, but with respect to a promised posterity. With what could seem like cruel irony, the Lord repeatedly pledged Abraham posterity as numerous as the dust of the earth and the stars of heaven. And he changed his name to Abraham, meaning a father of a multitude. Yet all the while, Abraham had no promised heir. All the while, Sarah and he were growing older. At last, of course, Isaac was born. Then Abraham's God, who seems to have a taste for this kind of irony, required the sacrifice of the very child through whom the prophecies that Abraham's seed would become great and mighty were to be fulfilled. How is it that Abraham staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but believed in the Lord who counted it to him for righteousness? We distort the trials of Abraham or of anyone else if we read them from a comfortable retrospective of history. Rather, as the Christian philosopher Kierkegaard reminds us, we must remember the fear and the trembling. We must flee with Abraham from Haran, not knowing whither we go, with eternity as our rock. Wander with Abraham, living in Canaan, living on increasingly ironic promises about possessing a land and having a great posterity. We must journey with Abraham to Mount Moriah, prepare the altar for Isaac, lift the knife. Only by becoming contemporaneous with the trials will we begin to understand why Abraham is called the father of the faithful. Only then will we understand why he is the model for all those who, like him, die in the faith, not having received the promises, as the writer of Hebrews says, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them. And they confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth, for they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country, a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. The scriptures are replete with examples of Abrahamic faith. Lehi's example comes readily to mind. Like Abraham, Lehi fled from his home, dwelt in a tent, and was led by faith to a better country. Also like Abraham, Lehi seems at least to have left Jerusalem, not knowing whither he went. Nephi's account, at any rate, depicts Lehi's first fleeing into the wilderness and only later learning that the Lord intended to lead him to a new world. That Lehi's family made several return trips to Jerusalem may be explained in part by the unfolding nature of their knowledge about the journey they were undertaking. Perhaps they had to learn that their exile was to be an exodus. Likewise, missionaries in every age, from the sons of Mosiah who journeyed into the lands of the Lamanites on the strength of a mere prophetic promise, to the modern-day missionaries like Wilford Woodruff, who followed the Spirit's prompting to go south to Hertfordshire, where he baptized hundreds, including one of my relatives, all missionaries have ever had to walk by faith. Indeed, all those who embrace the gospel become the progeny of Abraham, we are told, and like him have to walk by faith one step at a time. This includes our modern prophets. I'll never forget the day I had a conversation with President Harold B. Lee that taught me this. President Lee, who, by the way, loved that song, Lead Kindly Light, talked freely that day about a new program the church had just announced, and then he remarked that he'd just reread the minutes of the meetings in which that program had been formulated, and that he saw now, in retrospect, that the Lord had been guiding their deliberations all along. What a remarkable description of revelation. The Lord's guidance was not fully evident, even to his prophet, until President Lee turned to survey the terrain that he had traversed. The Lord led his servant, yes, but one step at a time. This lesson really impressed me, but it should not have surprised me. For even Jesus received not a fullness at first, but received grace for grace, and thus he was called the Son of God because he received not of a fullness at first. The Son because he received not of a fullness at first. Does this imply that Jesus' human limitations define the essence of his sonship or mortality, just as they do ours? That he had to learn his mission incrementally and live through trials without knowing the beginning from the end? I suppose that it does. Even Jesus Christ, for example, had to fast and pray often to obtain his Father's unfolding will. And Jesus' astonishing plea that he might not drink the bitter cup suggests that not even the Savior's prescience precluded his very human apprehension about the ordeal of the atonement. In this, as in all things, it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren. For verily he took upon him not the nature of angels, but took on him the seed of Abraham, we are told. Now, lest anyone think that these examples of faith are too remote, I wish to speak more personally, sharing some of my own experiences and those of others who have influenced me. I do so not to boast, but to bear witness of heaven's mercies and miracles. I do so in gratitude to the Lord and with the hope that my experiences may give others courage to hope. I come from a heritage of Abrahamic faith. John Tanner, the first Tanner to join the church, sold his beautiful farms in upstate New York and came to Kirtland, not knowing he was led there by the Spirit to help rescue the church from severe debt. Several more times he and his family left to follow the saints from Kirtland to Jackson, from Jackson to Nauvoo, from Nauvoo to Salt Lake. With each move, Father Tanner and his family became poorer. With each dislocation, they had to start anew. But because eternity was their rock, they left their progeny a faith more precious than gold. My paternal grandparents lost 2 grocery stores in the Depression. Their sole remaining possession of value was a home. Then came a call to their oldest son, my uncle, to go on a mission. My uncle assumed it would be impossible for him to serve. "Of course you'll go," said my grandparents. They sold their home and moved into an attic apartment. Friends were very critical, and from a practical perspective, their criticism was justified, for my grandparents lived many more years, but never again owned a home of their own. Yet they gave their sons something, including my father, something more valuable than an estate. They gave them an Abrahamic legacy of faith. Likewise, my own parents have walked with a faith of truly biblical proportions. Despite a world war, long years of school, and never knowing financial stability in their whole lives, they got an education. They had the family they expected the Lord would wanted them to. Mom walked across the stage to receive her diploma, conspicuously pregnant with her first child. 6 of us were born before my dad received his PhD. 7 more children were to come despite constant grinding economic uncertainty from my father's self-employment. Yet they sent 10 children on missions, often with more than one in the field at a time, and made sure that 13 graduated from college, all 13 of us. Now my folks worked very hard for this, and we too were expected to sacrifice, to save for missions, to put ourselves through college. But besides hard work, my parents demonstrated even more heroic faith. In these stories, it's easy to see, maybe too easy to see, the faith and and miss the fear. But you can't miss the fear and trembling when it's your own history. In 1974, when I was a senior at BYU, the job market for English professors was desperately tight and predicted to get much worse. In fact, as an aside, when I finally was accepted, I got a letter from my graduate school saying, "You're accepted," but the full page telling me, "Don't come because this is a terrible decision." It seemed only prudent at that time to do something practical, like apply to law school. All my friends did. All my roommates did. Even the ones that wanted to be philosophers. But as I wrote my letter to Duke Law School, I wrote the obligatory essay about why I want to be an attorney when I grow up. It struck me with the force of revelation that I did not want to be an attorney when I grew up. I wanted to teach, preferably in Renaissance literature. What's more, I felt the Lord wanted me to teach. So I tore up my essay and I applied instead to graduate schools in English. The distance seemed so uncertain, and all the forecasts said not to follow the less trodden path that I was taking. Yet that little light that illuminated my feet seemed to point to graduate school. And soon a way was opened up to go to UC Berkeley, but it was opened up only one step at a time. At about the same time that I tore up my application for law school, I got engaged. I was painfully aware that all I had to offer my bride were long years in school, and then the prospect of no employment in my chosen field, or if employment, very impecunious employment. Plus, I had only enough money for a quarter's tuition, and we both wanted children, Susan and I, and felt this was our first priority. I was inexpressibly happy about the marriage, but also very anxious and uncertain about the future. So I sought a blessing from my father, and I received, like Abraham, promises, cherished, treasured promises, but nothing you could take to the loan officer at the bank. The Lord is mindful of your desires, I was told. He knows your concerns and approves this marriage. The way will be opened up for you to complete your education through means which you cannot now conceive. 6 long years and 4 children later, I had my degree and, miraculously, a job in my field. Way after way, indeed, had been opened before us. For example, a house-sitting job that was to go, by the way, to David Magleby, who will be speaking next week. Anyway, that a house-sitting job that we thought would last only a few months became, through the generosity of the saintly Jim and Roma Sabine, 3 years of rent-free housing. I was able to find full-time employment as a night watchman in jobs which I could study at night and go to school all day. And even when we were making $60 a month in early morning seminary, we paid tithing and the Lord was on our right hand and on our left, lighting our way one step at a time. Many times, however, I doubted the future. Oh, I could meet the present distress. We could put up with the rice and beans and the rest of it. But I was anxious about the future. How often I would lament, what am I doing to myself and my family? There are no jobs in English. I can't complete a PhD anyway. After all, I almost flunked freshman English. I can't write. I can't even spell. What madness to think that I can do a dissertation. And still the years stretched on. Still, anxiety enveloped my faith. My former roommates completed law school and took real jobs, bought cars and homes. My best friend, in fact, went on to clerk at the Supreme Court, while I, meanwhile, pulled weeds in the Oakland Temple as a gardener and worried about completing a seemingly interminable degree. Yet I persisted, borrowing generously from the faith of my wife, whose unshakable conviction was that I should be in teaching. It was my vocation. And she kept us walking down an uncertain path, one step at a time. How much more courageously could have I lived on the promises had my faith been as strong as hers? I'm reminded of the ending of Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, which portrays Christian and hopeful crossing the river of death. There was no bridge over, Bunyan writes, and the river was very deep. The two pilgrims begin to despair, for there is no way across except through. Then they learn this truth. You shall find the river deeper or shallower as you believe in the king of the place. Susan generally finds the river shallower than I. Both of us, however, have had to wade, as do all probationers in mortality. To be human is to be a pilgrim and a stranger, homeward bound. No mortal ever ceases to need faith, for faith is the task of a whole lifetime. Indeed, to love, to repent, to believe, to forgive, these tasks are more than enough for any human life. Nor do moderns start ahead of the ancients with respect to these eternally significant tasks, such as faith and love. We all start where Adam and Eve did as they left the garden. Let me borrow from Milton's account of this, at their exit from the garden for a moment. The concluding lines of Paradise Lost read, "The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence for their guide. They hand in hand with wandering steps and slow through Eden took their solitary way." So the world that lies before us bids us choose our place of rest and offers us only Providence for our guide. If we're lucky, we'll find someone to hold hands with wandering steps and slow, we take our solitary way toward home. Now, since I have a university form for a minute, I want to illustrate my point, my theme, with one more personal example, and this a current experience. Then I'll offer one caution, and then I'm done. About a year ago, Bruce Hafen asked me to chair a committee that would draft recommendations on academic freedom. Knowing the issue had swamped far larger vessels than my poor craft, I did what any one of you would have done. I had an anxiety attack and looked for the nearest exit. Over the next several months, I tried a lot of creative evasion strategies. But I also felt a growing conviction that maybe, just maybe, this was work I was supposed to do. Perhaps unknown to me, this is why I studied Milton and Kierkegaard, two ardent advocates of liberty and faith. And I felt often the tug of Mordecai's question to Esther, remember? And who knoweth whether thou art come into the kingdom for such a time as this? So like Esther, I went forward, resolving, and if I perish, I perish. Way after way seemed to open as my committee came up against seeming impossible impasses. For this, I thank both heaven and the hard work and intelligence and goodwill of my committee. I do not say the work that we have done is inspired in every point. We've already received many good suggestions for improvements. But like President Lee, when I look back at where we have been, a journey that seemed sometimes torturous and circuitous in the treading of it, now the path seems straighter and more purposeful. I hope this work will bless the university. This has been the only intention of every member of the committee. And I hope that as BYU continues to grow as a community of thoughtful faith, it will also grow as a community of charity, which remembers that the prayer, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief, is a prayer of a believer. Now the final caution. What I have said today does not mean that we should seek out risk, court anxiety, or take reckless chances. There is a difference between foolhardiness and faith. And indeed, we have an obligation to prepare for the future, to count the costs before we build. If, in fact, you are the sort of person that likes risks, that is reckless, this is not the talk for you. We should be careful, and we should be wise. Nevertheless, we must not trust ever only our own wisdom. As George Santayana asserts, it is not wisdom to be only wise and on the inward vision close the eyes, but it is wisdom to believe the heart. Columbus found a world without a chart and had no chart save the one that faith deciphered in the skies. Our knowledge is a torch of smoky pine that lights the pathway but one step ahead, across a void of mystery and dread. Bid then the tender light of faith to shine, by which alone the mortal heart is led unto the thinking of the thought divine. May the Lord light our various pathways, even though it be but one step ahead, across a void of mystery and dread. And may we, as covenant children of Abraham, have the faith to follow that heavenly light home. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.